Jika, and welcome to A Portrait of Us, an NGV podcast where Australia's art becomes an instigator for holding deeper conversations about life, culture, and the incredible diversity of this country. I'm Brooke Blurton, and in this podcast, I get to talk to some of Australia's most significant artists. Together, we'll delve into how art reflects, challenges, and enriches our perspectives, drawing us closer to one another through dialogue and discovery. Here, art isn't just observed. It's our meeting point, our bridge to connect. In each episode, I speak with artists who embody the experiences and stories that make up Australia today. This podcast is all about celebrating Australian art and its people in its many shapes and forms. In this episode, we're exploring the profound connection between art and the natural world, with a focus on the intricate relationship between culture, landscape, and preservation. Our guests, Dr. Pirjo Haikola and Dr. Deanne Gilson, may come from different worlds, but they are united by their deep commitment to preserving the beauty and biodiversity of this country. Pirjo brings her unique underwater perspective, while Deanne's paintings capture the spirit of the land. Joining them is NGV Curator of First Nations Art, Michael Gentle, who will guide us through the cultural significance of Deanne and Pirjo's unique art practices. Together, we'll delve into the ways that art can inspire us to care for our natural heritage and deepen our connection to the land and its stories. Pirjo is a designer, researcher, certified diving instructor, sailor, and ocean advocate. Her work centres on the development of more than human design, specifically focusing on exploring how industrial design can contribute to environmental restoration. Fostering ocean literacy through public engagement and teaching is also one of Pirjo's passions. Her design and artistic projects combine additive manufacturing with material experimentation and other media. Pirjo is a research collaborator in the Reef Restoration and Adaptation Program for the Great Barrier Reef since 2020. She is currently lecturing in design, innovation and technology at RMIT University in Melbourne. Pirjo's work has been exhibited widely, including Urchin Corals and Process at NGV's Sampling the Future exhibition in 2021 and Urchin Corals in the NGV 2020 Triennial. Deanne is a Wadawurrung woman of Aboriginal and Australian English descent with an art practice spanning nearly 40 years. After spending her early childhood in Melbourne, Gilson relocated to her ancestral country around Ballarat at 7 years old, where she nurtured a deep appreciation for Indigenous plants, trees and flowers, many of which feature prominently in her work today. Recently, her work before Joseph Banks, Our Baskets and Plants Held Sacred Knowledge, was displayed in NGV's 2023 exhibition, Melbourne Now. This work is a series of 10 still lives, depicting medicine and healing Indigenous plants in baskets that are indicative of traditional woven vessels from around Australia. Deanne completed her PhD at Deakin University, looking at the objectification of Aboriginal women by the male colonial gaze. I guess what does the theme Now More Than Ever mean to you in terms of your work and in terms of the environment and even reconciliation?
Wow. Well, now more than ever for me, it's about just getting our stories out there right now and highlighting, you know, the issues that we've had in the past that we still have that are continuing and just post-referendum, you know, just talking about things. And if we're not going to come forward now, well, when? So, like with my practice too, I just try and, you know, they say I'm not overly political, but I think everything in my practice, even if it is just a flower of the pre-Joseph Banks, it's all political. Mm. And it's all, you know, saying that, you know, I'm talking a lot about trauma and loss in my work, even though you might see a beautiful bunch of bush plants, bush foods and everything, but they've got a whole story and a history that's over 65,000 years old.
It's interesting you bring that up, Brooke, now more than ever. And I know, Deanne, you've got some works which reference the past, such as your basket works, which are like quasi-appropriations of Margaret Preston in many ways, which is obviously drawing on the past to kind of communicate a narrative which is really pressing right now.
Yeah.
How do you see drawing on history and historical moments as kind of being really important to your arts practice and communicating very contemporary issues?
Wow. A lot of it we haven't even started talking about things yet. Previously, when we had another conversation, I'm in my late 50s and we weren't even allowed to talk about things in my childhood. It was all squashed down, and I think it was Marie Clark or somebody quoted that our culture's been sleeping, especially in Victoria. So, of course, it's so important. And drawing on Margaret Preston, you know, that wasn't even the starting point. But I guess because I've used the basket as a vessel, which Margaret painted still life, so that vessel interpretation for me has gone into Indigenous knowledges and my matriarchal women making the baskets, and my sister continues making baskets today. And I'm just depicting those stories, but then I was finding all these other layers of stories and going, okay, I can be a bit cheeky here and talk about, well, why was Margaret Preston using Indigenous iconography and taking colours of country and symbols and marks that were sacred men and women's business? Mm. They were none of her business. And she was taking them and incorporating them into her still lives. And although I paint what you would look at as a still life, I don't see it as still life. I see it as something other that exists separate to Western genres of art. It's Aboriginal storytelling, it's telling the truth, it's sometimes it is just depicting a beautiful plant like a kangaroo apple or a bush food, just because they are so beautiful. And but then the layers of the stories and what the plants told and everything. So it kind of gets more and more complicated for me as I go along. But that use of the charcoal from my mum's fire is just something, you know, constantly that connection with my mum. And then I see Preston also use charcoal, but to tell somebody else's story from this country that she was trying to create a new Australian style, but we don't have a style as such. We tell our stories through our practice and through artworks, and whether it be traditional, you know, cave paintings or bark paintings or in the sand.
One more thing from me on that, Deanne, is that what I've noticed, what you've been saying, is the significance of locality and reducing things down. Yes. Artists like Margaret Preston saw a design and all they saw was the typology or the visual field of the design, nothing more than that, right? What you're doing in your practice is taking these things and relating them back to cultural knowledge, cultural stories, practices, narratives that are personal to you and your mob. That's something that's kind of come up in contemporary environmental discourse, is locality and things on global and local scales. We all have stories to share on really small, intimate scales.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of discourse recently about individual relationships to climate change have been shifting. I feel like in the past 5 years or so, it was all about individual responsibility. Less waste, how much energy you're consuming, all of this. It was all kind of taken down to an individual level. Whereas I think things have shifted recently. We've started looking broader scale about collective responsibility to climate change. For you, Dr. Perio, how does your design practice or design research-based practice kind of engage with local versus global and personal stories versus kind of global metaphors for solving issues?
Mm. I mean, we are at a time when we really have to act in a big scale.
Yeah.
And even though all the interventions that we're designing are very, very site-specific, the work that I do with the research projects that I'm working on or collaborations that I have in different types of areas with designing for non-human clients. They're all very site-specific, but they are all targeted to have a really big impact. So you have really big groups of people working together from different disciplines to understand those challenges and how do we address them appropriately on that particular site. So some of those technologies or systems or things that we design or materials may be appropriate for another site, but there's still always the need to really design the intervention specifically to a very particular place.
Yeah.
But of course, when I'm thinking about, say, the Great Barrier Reef, it is a global issue. Hmm. If we start losing reef systems, and we are losing them slowly, that's a global problem as well. But we have to address them both globally and on the site in all different scales, basically.
I'm not sure if you spoke about this last time, but I'd be really interested to hear what you have to say, Brooke and Deanne. In contemporary ecological discourse, the non-human or the more than human or the post-human is kind of a common term that people use to reference anything other than.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Country kind of sits in a weird place in terms of non-humanness.
Yeah.
I had a discussion with a researcher from Monash a few years ago about the status of the Birrarung as a human or given the rights of a human through the Victorian Parliament. And when we talk about country, we tend to talk about it as within us, around us, of us.
Mm.
So how do you feel like the concept of non-human fits in for mob, like for country? How does it make you feel hearing that like the landscape is a non-human when we kind of conceive of country as like family?
I think the connection or the feeling with country and my personal and my culture is like so entwined and so interconnected. Like I'm not non-human, therefore country feels human to me in some way. Yeah, I don't know.
I think I have to mention here that the the term why we often talk about non-human versus a human is because, say, in industrial design, which is my background, all the ways of thinking or designing for someone come from designing for another human being. Right? And we understand other human beings with the very different ways, you know, like different methods that we use. We interview them, we have workshops and focus groups and all sorts of things to really understand what these people will need. But when all of a sudden your client is a coral, like in my case, you can't ask them, what do you want? What kind of house would you like? That doesn't really work. So we have to use very different kinds of methods. And therefore, the distinction between human and non-human is very useful in a very technical sense.
Mm. Yeah.
And I think that's the distinction that I would like to make, or a disclaimer in a sense, that we need to specify that when we're designing for a non-human entity who we can't ask if they like it or not, we have to use different methods and we have to make sure that we also take their, how would you say, perspective on wealth needs into account in the correct kind of way.
If we, however, reposition design epistemologies through First Nations lens and speaking to country, singing to country, conversing with country, traditional owners, elders, community who are engaging with country on that level and they are speaking to country, how do we think those two things
How can we talk to each other about it?
Yeah,
I think
exactly.
That's interesting.
I guess with my practice, I always see country as living. And I always talk about when I use ochres, the microorganisms in the ochre are alive, so therefore the painting's alive. So it is that direct connection with country and almost human-like, you know, because it's still life as we know it. But there is also another little thing that with my practice, because I depict our creation story a lot in especially my tree paintings, and the bark from the manigam was taken to form the first birds, the birds first, and then the humans with clay from the riverbed. So the bark then, in that metaphorical sense, becomes skin. Mm. So skin and kin with the trees. So the trees, they were non-humans, but perhaps in our culture, in our story, the tree is our connection to life.
Mm. So I think it's really interesting that, obviously what we're talking about is connection and care for the environment and how much we care for the trees and the plants and the animals and how do we have to take care of them in order for us all to survive together. And then there's that tension of having to then kind of separate them into these technical research areas, in my case,
yeah.
Which does sometimes feel a little bit clinical and technical, but it depends, I guess, what you're doing and how you have to achieve the result that you want.
And I guess design is one of those fields which for me has always felt really inaccessible. Like, I know art, art's my thing, so I feel very comfortable around it,
yeah.
But design's always kind of been that next step. Design and architecture have always been something that I've kind of struggled to go, okay, what are we talking about
yeah.
here? And I think that's just by me not putting in enough effort to engage it. And whenever I talk to designers, sometimes I get lost because they think so abstractly, and it's like a painting happening in their mind when they're talking
yeah.
about design, because
yeah.
ideas just kind of flow and come in together and have a conversation about concepts that I haven't even like thought of before. And so I think when we talk about what Deanne and Brooke were saying with First Nations knowledges and kind of seeing country as us, as ourselves, as human, that doesn't really fit in the into design, which kind of sits in that academic world and kind of has to in some ways, because people are making naive and speculative and conceptual and abstracted hypotheses about where design can take us to solve these environmental issues. And sometimes First Nations knowledge, it doesn't really get a seat at that table because it doesn't like to be categorized.
Yeah.
It doesn't like to sit neatly in different boxes. I heard this really beautiful quote recently, and it was, being an expert is a colonial mindset.
Yes.
And First Peoples like to know a little bit about a lot of things rather than giving one person the power to know everything. And so I think that's why our knowledges, they kind of disperse over everywhere.
But I think that actually fits very well with what I see what we have to do now. Because the challenges that we have are extremely complex. So again, in the project addressing the Great Barrier Reef, we are hundreds of people in the project. And only with this collective intelligence of everyone together, we can design something. One person alone cannot do that.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the Great Barrier Reef project?
Yeah, so it is the Reef Restoration Adaptation Program, and we've been working for several years now. I joined the group 4 years ago, and we're working on different interventions to help Great Barrier Reef resist the climate change for a little bit longer. And we are developing a system to basically deliver millions of enhanced corals to the reef in a few years' time. So it's a massive scientific and engineering and a little bit of design challenge as well. We do have traditional owners as part of the project, and increasingly so. And there is a great aim to really integrate the two perspectives and two ways of seeing things and these two different ways of delivering the designs as well. So
I was gifted, you know, like this, I call it a gift, and people might not be able to define it. First Nations people's knowledge sometimes can't really be boxed. And so my mum was pregnant with me, and she was in the water, and all these beautiful green sea turtles were popping up for a breath of fresh air around her, like perfectly in a dome. Like, I don't know how you can describe that. But my grandmother was sitting on the shore, just sitting on her bum and watching all these, you know, little turtles pop up for this little breath of fresh air, and mum's buoyant, you know, hanging out in the water. In my family, if an animal shows up during that time when a mother is pregnant, that's kind of like a spirit guide, or that's a connection that baby has with an animal. Like, how do you define that? And so I've always been really passionate. So I was gifted with the barangara, which is a green sea turtle in my language. That's what we call it. And so I've had this connection with this green sea turtle. And from a little young age, that is my connection to the environment, is through this animal as well, through the ocean. You can't define that in my eyes. Like, you can't just be like, how do I explain this to non-Aboriginal people?
It's
right?
such an ephemeral moment that for so many of us shapes the trajectory of our life. And I feel like a lot of First Peoples knowledges, it comes from moments like that for us. These kind of accidents that just kind of pop up, and then a story is born, and then that story is carried through a family, right? And I think that's knowledge and First Peoples, not that we work slowly, But things happen slowly because things take time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Things have to take time because people need the time to process, to learn, to change, to show, to teach, to grow.
Yeah.
But it's noted, isn't it?
It is.
And the family have seen it and and they're connecting, you know, with something other that you can't see, but they know that there's a reason why for that moment.
And those embodied knowledges for you now every time you see or come across the green sea turtle, that carries so much potency.
This is the weird thing about this whole scenario is that I've always been inherently passionate about the environment and ocean and obviously climate change and the crisis that we're sort of in. So I've been really outwardly spoken about it and, you know, brands who want to do the same thing and help have reached out. And I worked with a brand who had partnered with the Great Barrier Reef Foundation, and I was kind of putting all the pieces together, and they took me on this trip and they were talking about these designs that they were creating to restore the reef. And Dr. Pirro is the designer of those.
Oh, one of them. One of them.
Exactly.
Yeah. That is amazing.
Yeah, that was wild. And we just realised it's sort of
accidentally. The confluence of all of these different worlds coming together. It's amazing.
Exactly. And in that moment, I don't know if this is just also a bit of a spooky moment, me oversharing, was they'd been out in the water for ages and they were like, "We're normally a lot of the, you know, reef animals, they'll come up and they interact." They hadn't. No one, like, it was quiet. It was very quiet. There was a few fish that came out. And anyways, I was like, all right, well, like, I'll go out just as I do. put my wetsuit on back to front. It's a bit silly. So I was laughing about it. So I was taking a bit of time to do that. And then I got straight into the water and within 5 minutes, a turtle had come up and was just, like, swimming side by side. Let it sort of, like, show me where it's going. And I had this really beautiful moment and I was like, this solidifies my connection. And how do you define that? I know, you know.
It's beautiful. Of course, I don't have that connection, but my family has always been really close to nature and, you know, my family has been in the same place also a very long time in Finland. And I always did go out, like, gathering berries or fishing or all kinds of stuff with my dad, and the water was always really close to me. But only when I started diving many years later, I kind of found the environment where I really connected. And I moved to the work at the Great Barrier Reef from Cairns, and that happened to be the summer with this really bad, massive bleaching happening. And we were there. We were diving instructors working there, and we had all these tourists asking us what's going on, and media was going crazy. That was one of the first times when this became really like a global thing that, oh my God, the Great Barrier Reef is dying and all this kind of stuff were in the headlines. And we were there and we saw it happening and it totally broke my heart. It was just horrible to see so quickly how things changed. And it took me a few years to turn my practice around. I had kind of left design because I felt it was such a superficial practice. I didn't want to make more stuff to this world it didn't need. And I became a diving instructor instead. And I thought, that's it. I'm out. And then I'm there, I'm watching this happen, and I'm like, well, could my skills in some way be useful in this situation? Can design be a practice that can help restore something?
Off of that, Deanne, how do you feel? Obviously, it's taken a lot for mob in this country to fight for recognition and rights and representation, and only recently, like, words like country and connection to country have entered really the mainstream, education, etc.
Yeah.
But I always feel like community is always saying that everyone has a connection to a place.
Yes.
Everyone in the world, you have to. You come from somewhere, right? Our connection is obviously to this continent and to the nations in which we all respectively come from. With fighting climate change, changing climates, there's this desire that we're doing it now out of a rush, or we're being told quickly we have to change this right now, which is true. It's dire situations. We're quickly trying to turn things around. And I wrote an essay on this recently for Artlink about how our connection to the environment, it's often framed through empathy. I feel sad for the environment. You have to do this because we've done it. Like, you feel sad now, right? But if we go back to the concept of country and country being a not non-human, it doesn't come from a place of empathy because the environment exists within us. And so now it's about saving the planet for the sake of, if we don't, we too will be gone as well. And I think repositioning that kind of changes how we then might
find... We are part of the world. We are not separate from it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we find everyone finds connection to place then. I guess the question is, how do you feel about non-Indigenous people in Australia finding connection to place? How do you think people do that? Because I think people get scared about not being mob and not being... people get scared of not...
I feel weird about sometimes, especially in this conversation now, I feel a little bit awkward because I'm an immigrant.
Yeah.
And although I feel like I have a connection, obviously it's not the same. I'm not from here. So I think that's interesting. Thank you for that
question. With all my cultural education workshops with school children, they've all got to find their identity and their sense of place. And that's the one thing that when we're talking about, you know, I'm connected to country, this is my ancestral lands, and, you know, you say all of those things in workshops. But then I say, but it is a shared space now, and this is your home too, because they have to feel safe and they have to have a home. And then we all have to take care of everything. So I've found a way to talk about connection with other people other than First Peoples. You know, it's your home too, and you've got to be connected, and through that connection then you start wanting to take care of country.
Exactly.
But if you don't have that, we just say, oh no, you're not from here, you know, it's not your place.
I worry about a lot of people in the city, like in a bigger city like Melbourne or Sydney, who don't really spend any time outside of the concrete and glass and steel. I worry that they just, they don't have enough connection. They can't care enough because they just don't have a personal relationship with it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can only create that if you spend time there.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I guess that takes me back to creating, making and designing for climate change. It is a rapid problem, but things take time. So how do we intersect First Peoples' knowledges that take time and necessarily so for something that we need to have fixed yesterday? It's kind
and
of
with science and the speed of innovation that goes very fast, they kind of seem to be a little bit at odds with each other sometimes.
Yeah, it feels like there's a bit of, it reminds me of, this is an annoying nerdy reference, but the Italian futurists were very obsessed with like speed
and
violence, and just like they wanted the body to be this kind of like very masculine, fast, speedy thing, right? Yeah. And that's what science always feels like to me. It's constantly changing, go, 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 to like battle something bigger every day. Whereas there tends to be a kind of more gentle softness to knowledge from country because it takes time to nurture those things. So how do those two worlds
sit? Do they meet?
Where do they have a conversation?
I would say that it goes back to the previous conversation we were having. It's the care and the connection. And what are we doing it for? We are not doing the science or innovation or design for the sake of creating new products in this case or something like that. We are doing it to help the environment thrive and different animals and plants and us ourselves to feel better and to survive for longer. So I think the purpose is really what drives me and my work, whether it's artistic or design or research. And I think the purpose is what can really connect us too. And that helps in a big group of people, of hundreds of people working, First Peoples and scientists and engineers.
Yeah.
I think the purpose is what connects us.
In terms of cognitive psychology, though, if our, like, emotions, thoughts and behaviours are all connected in a triangle ABC, right?
Yeah.
If we treat something, behave towards it nicely, we're affirming positive thoughts in our mind about it and inherently going to have positive emotions towards the thing, right? Engendering empathy, kindness, softness, care. If you're saying horrible things to something, it's going to perpetuate negative cycles of thoughts, which I think a lot of large institutions, the government, etc., it doesn't necessarily engender those positive narratives with nature. It doesn't facilitate those kinds of relationships. And that's obviously a very systematic way of suppressing First Peoples' connection and knowledge, which is so ready to be shared with people and lead the way, but it's consistently kind of hidden under the rug. How have you felt about that throughout your practice and your education career as well, Deanne?
Oh, look, I mean, Yeah, it's been difficult, actually. It's probably the last 5 years where I've really been able to practice and, you know, speak my truth and tell the stories that I've been wanting to tell. And I've been telling the stories for 20 years and no one listened. But now all of a sudden it's quite popular to have a cultural educator in schools and places where there was nothing. So going back to the plant, I guess too, if you look at it from a First Peoples perspective too, was one plant to start with, even though it looked as healthy, less healthy than the other one too. So, you know, bring it back to the health of the plant too, and that sort of there's the seen and the unseen. And it's just so difficult to know. But definitely I would say, though, with those negative voices coming at you constantly, it's a constant battle. And, you know, I shouldn't be talking post-referendum again, but the voices are loud and it's quite confronting and you could almost shut down and do nothing. But I guess a lot of us have decided to do more.
Yeah.
So, bringing it back to just, speaking about our stories.
I like you saying kindness. I think that's like, even if you're being kind to a plant, but being kind to living beings in general, I think, and caring for them is something that we need to adopt, because that will, on a greater scheme of things, if we all care more and are more kind to each other and the world, I think we can do something.
Yeah. And it's really scary to think about the legacies of the agricultural industry. I grew up in the wheat belt in Western Australia on Wilmanbudja in Wandering. And it's very fascinating to trace when you move across the continent or move from rural to urban, the legacy of people's relationship to the environment as something that is to be taken, to be controlled, to give something.
Yeah.
And then you spend more time in a very progressive industry, such as the arts, which I think sometimes can be a scary little bubble as well, because it makes us feel a little too comfortable and we forget that there's outsiders looking in. And I mean, in reference to what you said, Deanne, I mean, that's very obvious. There's a whole cohort of people that we just forget about sometimes. This legacy of settler agricultural relationships to the land and how it still pervades, but it sits within people that we don't even know that they're thinking that. And it's difficult when a school is asking for a cultural advisor, a traditional owner, an elder, community to come and share stories. And of course we would always do so in any instance sharing with design, we would all do so with our most heartfelt intent. But I often think about the places that are putting energy into that are just such a small cohort, and it's like, how do you break out of these domains of people who have become comfortable with progressive, radical, maybe ancient knowledges, kind of changing the way that we think? But then how do you expand out of that to really help the continent move forward and the nation move forward?
I think there's a lot of levels where you can do that, and not every person can do everything, right? Obviously, like, we all have our own little spheres of influence where we can do something, and our own areas where we can, people around us or communities around us that we can influence, whether you teach at the university like I do, or whether you're an advisor in schools, or you can make a difference through the people that you interact with. And of course, industry is a different beast, but, you know, if we all work in the areas where we can, we just have to do the best we can in those areas. We can't do everything. And I think that's where people get really quite desperate, if they think we have to solve everything and you have to, you know, what do we do with industry? Somebody there will have influence in that industry and will start to create change in there. But we can't all be expected to do everything.
I love that. I think that's really, it's a beautiful reminder of locality and that we exist in a community and that's where we have influence. And it's such a, it's a really gentle reminder, I think, that we have the power to change at least one little thing in our life, and we can't be the heroes of the earth. If we do want to change the world, that's when we come together as a collective. Like,
you find out what you're good at and you start to strive for that. And my case, I tried to do it for my artistic work, my design work, through teaching my students and my PhD students, PhD researchers, and, you know, working together with them, figuring out different ways we can act and do better. That's the change in the way that we can. And I have to be comfortable with that, for instance, because otherwise I lose my mind. I can't I can't change the world, but I can change these little bits.
Brooke, how have you felt kind of living in Victoria, off country? How do you feel navigating bringing your mob to somewhere else?
When I first moved here, it was a hard adjustment for me, growing up in NWA and having so much open land and living on the coast and being the warm weather and being so wrapped in nature and the ocean, and that sort of fulfilled self-love for me, I guess, like having that connection. And then I guess adjusting to moving to Melbourne, where it is very concrete and I don't have that same connection. There are little ways that I've incorporated home for me. Having little pieces from my home into my home in Melbourne have helped. So it sort of reminds me, like, you know, I've got this artwork that, you know, reminds me, I look at it and I love it's, you know, sunset over the ocean and I'm like, oh, that's home. Like, I'll get back to that one day. So there's those little things. But in terms of like that, having that connection, it's, yeah, there's a disconnect, which is very, it impacts my mental health for sure, having sun and being in the ocean. And I try to get back to WA as often as I can. But yeah, I mean, I also am also reminded when I went on the Great Barrier Reef Foundation trip, I picked up a bit of bleached coral on the sand and I was like, oh my God. So like I have this little reminder of like what I don't want to happen as well. And I guess on, you know, like having that influence, you know, Dr. Pirro having an influence on her students, I have a really great platform to use that to make noise and to advocate for the things that I am passionate about, which, yeah, I know a lot of people have the privilege of. My reach is like I've got 266,000 people on Instagram alone, and if I can use that platform to advocate for what we need to do and I guess the responsibility that we have, then I will. And I try to. But, yeah, it does get a little bit frustrating because I work also in an industry that is very fabricated and very saturated with materialism and colonialism and patriarchy, and it just like frustrates me so much because I've been so inherently grounded in my identity as a Noongar girl living on country, and here I am in the city advocating for something that I don't have as well right now. So it is,
I think that's the thing, is like when I get frustrated that I'm not doing enough or my impact is not big enough, no matter what I do, it's that purpose that still is the only thing that can carry you. So if you have that purpose of how you want to make a change and how you want to impact the world, then that's what you have to dig deep into in those moments when it feels really hard. And that will keep you going and drives you.
And I think for mob, country is one of those things that gives you purpose. And so it's tricky when you're living off country and you feel elevated and celebrated and excited by your country, of course, and you would do anything for that. So it's tricky because we're always moving off and on, around and in between and all of these things. So
intersectionality like is so, you know, obvious. I mean, it's also like how you introduce yourself, I guess, what you identify with. I think in all the titles and, you know, things that we do in our life, like one thing I always introduce myself or come back to is like, I am Brooke, but I'm Noongar, you know, like I'm, this is my country. This is my identity. And that's that again, that's what sort of I come back to because it's who I am. And it's also what I'm most proud of.
Those introductions are for me have always kind of represented a mechanism of fighting climate change, because when we introduce each other as mob, we say where we're from. Sometimes you say who your family is, and you are inherently embodying locality, and you're positioning yourself in a place where you have influence and you feel connected to, and that's where you can create change in comparison to other people who don't feel a responsibility to a place. They don't feel connected and maybe don't want to feel connected to anywhere because they're just laissez-da walking around the landscape, taking it for granted, which again is a legacy of that colonial relationship to the land.
How beautiful if you could figure out a way to translate that to other people, how we could have something that, like, I don't want to say I'm a designer. What I stand for is more I'm trying to change something for the environment.
I mean, I feel connected to you. Like, I feel like, you know, in this environment,
I think,
like,
we have to invent new titles. That's what I'm trying to get at, is that maybe the titles that we have, the professional ones, are not the ones that we should use,
because
as well.
They sometimes create gaps
barriers, for sure.
Exactly. And you're so much more than your label. I was giving a tour today and talking about how labels of identity create gaps in our own capacity to self-identify.
Yeah.
And I was talking about Gordon Bennett, who was a very well-known Australian painter who passed away in 2014. And he was First Nations, but in the 90s, he found out when he was kind of a teenager, his mother was stolen. And he rejected his indigeneity as kind of a title. He didn't want to, and much like Tracy Moffat and other artists who have done similar, because they felt like being an Indigenous artist brought upon all of these ideas of self that they just didn't feel like were relevant to them.
Yeah.
And I think that framework, thinking about when we're given a marker of identity, designer, curator, it comes with a lot of stereotypes and cliches which box us in, and that's like anything, and that's why language is so important about coming together and creating collective change, and also striking relationships between people who wouldn't necessarily engage with one another on a day-to-day basis. And I think that's what this podcast is kind of achieving in some way, is bringing two people together, and we're breaking everyone down, not in like a horrible way, like, come on.
Yeah, breaking the disciplinary boundaries,
exactly. And just saying, like, we all have something in common.
I agree.
Yeah.
And I mean, with Gordon Bennett too, it wasn't really safe times to, you know, say who you were and practice your culture and do it in that space where, you know, he did it sort of subtly. And then it all came out, didn't it? It all came out. And then, you know, and then, as you know, he did struggle. So I think it's probably the same with me too, just having this really sort of non-cultural childhood where you couldn't mention who you were and you couldn't actually say who you were and where you were from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is a new thing, and I think we also do it in that resistance and proudness, and also the fact that we are still here. So it's become sustainability. Sort of, it's like we're introducing ourselves actually for the first time quite often.
And isn't it? Yeah. Since 67, and obviously a lot of key moments throughout the 1900s and. The past two decades as well, last year.
Big change,
there's been all of these really significant changes that have really impacted how First Peoples knowledge is celebrated, how it's even known and shared with ourselves, but then also with the broader public. It's been such a small amount of time that all of this has happened in, and now we've kind of reached a point where we're facing climate crisis and we have to now suddenly intersect with these other disciplines that have been kind of slowly hacking away at it as well, and now we're ready to kind of work together. But it's like there's so much pain and so much trauma, and now it's like now you have to put your big boy shoes on, and we have to like share knowledge,
forget about everything.
Exactly,
can't imagine.
I mean, that makes me feel uncomfortable, like to think of
that is an unsettling way of putting it, to be honest.
But that's the thing about community leaders, right, is that there are some people who are ready to do that.
Yeah. And that have carried that out as well.
Yeah, exactly. And those are the people who are ready to share, and they are so strong and so knowledgeable.
Even speaking on our younger generations, I think, like, there's a willingness of learning and being openness of appreciating those who have carried that out for us. And it, for me, like, culture is a gift.
Yeah.
It's such a gift. I used that word before because I wouldn't have this and I wouldn't have my identity without that. And I wouldn't be passionate about country if I didn't have that. And that's kind of what drives everything. And there is a willingness. I speak for a younger generation in a sense that we are listening, and we want our elders and we want our ancestors to feel seen and feel heard in that process, but we want to do more. And I think that's why I brought the sort of theme up now more than ever, because I feel an urgency, and I feel like we're in a, not even in an amber zone, like a red zone.
But I think
zone.
Often crisis can bring people together, right? So now it's a crisis that's much bigger than any one of us individually.
Yeah.
And now more than ever, I think it's the time that hopefully we can put differences aside as much as we can and try to find ways that we can improve things, and make things better.
Yeah, I think one of the good things about your discipline is that it feels very open to making those intersections happen, and not just looking past the differences, but also looking at the differences.
Yeah,
I feel like
bringing
the good
them
thing about our two worlds is that they kind of both have this a little bit of pride.
Yeah,
I think
of course. Yeah.
They both design and mob both have quite a bit of pride.
Yeah.
And they're both quite sure of themselves.
Yeah.
So I think that makes for kind of a good combination, because
it's
quite forthright and very radical and very ready to make change.
And that's what we really need.
Yeah,
I mean, if we can bring in the best parts of both worlds and all the different worlds that we have, that's the only way.
Definitely.
And I think that kindness too, that sustainability.
I think that's the glue, right?
Yeah.
Maybe that's the word, be kind, and don't know. But it is important time, and I'm just grateful that I've had an opportunity to make art that talks about we've gone through the past and now we're looking towards a future, especially with teaching mainly primary school children. So that's my focus. Firstly, it was about my children and how they're going to have their future, their sustainability, they're my grandson, and now it's about all the other children, because they've got to work with them.
Yep.
And I think the one thing too that I mentioned with my practice that was last time when we were talking, was about both my boys working with the environment, and especially my eldest son, Blair, working as a cultural fire officer and working along CFA, doing those cultural fire burns. And my sister also does that, and she's a weaver. So they're very aware of what the grasses are doing and the flaxes and the weaving materials and the cultural burns. You know, you couldn't, farmers weren't allowed to actually burn off. And so this country's in such a state now that they're trying to catch up with the cultural burns to just lightly burn country and heal country and everything. And then I come along looking for ochre and using charcoals from mum's fire and noticing the huge changes, especially in the last 20 years since I've been gathering from the same places, because the places I gather from, especially the white ochre from the Yuyangs, is part of our ceremony. So we keep doing the same thing over and over again as our ancestors did, and we know it's safe there and it's good country there and so on, and it's connecting to their story, to our stories, and the changes. And there's been some horrific changes. Some places I can't go now because they're either closed off or they're unsafe, or the rubbish, the amount of rubbish in places is really quite bad. And, you know, it's just all part of and I guess my job's easier than my children's job, because I'm painting little snippets of country, and, you know, I'll pick up some images, I'll go and photograph a grass tree, and they only flower after the smoke and the fire, and they are part of our fire story. They were used to create fire. And so it's kind of that full circle. This plant has so much knowledge.
But that's the interesting thing. It's like environmental literacy that you're creating, really, and showing it to the public.
Mm.
And the way I see my artistic work, that's ocean literacy, showing things about the ocean that people don't know of, and people are very unfamiliar with that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what art can do there. We can create this effect of literacy and teach people about things they don't understand.
Okay. Deanne, you spoke really beautifully just then about making these returns to place to gather materials for your work, and obviously materiality, First Nations, artistic expression, those two things are very kind of interconnected. You can't do one without the other. And Design is also kind of one of those disciplines where the materiality is almost inseparable from the outcome or the process as well. So in terms of Deanne making these returns, Dr. Pirio, does design make returns to older materials, or is it constantly kind of looking forward for new ones?
I think that's also a really interesting time right now. I think we are doing both, and I see a lot of people doing both. For instance, some of my research students are looking at very traditional materials and using them, of course, for environmental purposes, because that's what we kind of do. But at the same time, we are kind of inventing new materials as well, but with the purpose of them reintegrating in nature also.
Okay.
So there's an interesting full circle there in a way of not just inventing new materials that will go somewhere that we don't know where they are going, as we used to do, but we are trying to do the same as natural materials would do.
And I love that both worlds have circles coming back, right? And I think that's, I'm obviously just very sentimental, but I think it's a very beautiful metaphor,
it's
knowing that these two worlds are kind of happening separately, but creating similar patterns, which acts as that connective tissue between the two, knowing that, we all function mostly in a similar way. Mm. We make returns to things and come back.
We do.
Yeah.
And if we look at that connection to nature, we are all made of materials, right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If
of course.
We want to talk about it in that way.
Exactly. I mean, there's bugs in us. We are, I mean, if we're talking about non-human, our body, our humanness is already non-human.
Exactly.
There are bugs in us, water, things, microplastics, things from medicine that are all completely what we would say is are not human. And so it's kind of futile to single us out as these human superiors against the world when really
so
we're
dependent on our environment in so many ways, really integrally.
Every group that we have come into the art gallery in Ballarat, every single child does a dance that I created called the Win Murrup, and it's the water spirit. And we just do some gentle steps left to right, and we just move our hands to the beat of the clapsticks, and they have to feel the water in their body and then connect to the water, and then they become aware that we need water to survive and live, and we have to take care of the water.
It's
so
beautiful.
Just a gentle way, and it warms the children up and they get all excited. And, and
I have this one thing that there was a sentence that to talk about the ocean and the way all the beings were born in the ocean, and that we left the water but we kept it inside our bodies, because actually the liquid inside our body is very similar salinity to the seawater, and life in our bodies is still born in salt environment, saline environment. So we left the ocean, but we kept it inside.
That's really beautiful.
I think that's amazing.
All of these stories about water, maybe it was meant to happen, the water dance, the green sea turtle,
the
water inside of us.
Yeah.
No, it's beautiful. I love that.
Or serendipitous.
And I've got to add to that. I saw on last Friday three Willy Wagtails. We called Jirrawit the messenger birds, and there was three, and I made a connection Friday with it, but I think I've just made another one with Jirrawit, because they come to tell you something. They don't hold back. When you see Willy Wagtails, you know there's a reason. So I think, and it's about life and death and that cycle of life. So
hopefully
I think
it's about life today.
Yeah, today that is very much about life.
For sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's such a beautiful ending to such a great episode.
Yeah, absolutely.
I just want to say thank you so much. I've learned so much during
this chat.
Deanne and Dr. Pirio, and Michael, this one has just been so beautiful.
Thank you for joining me on this episode. I would like to acknowledge that this conversation took place on Wurundjeri Woiwurrung country. We pay our respects to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who are listening, as well as the elders past, present and emerging. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land.